what makes this somewhat unique is the fact that they haven't been in the Alaskan airspace in about 2 years.
Fighter jets intercept Russian bombers near Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, April 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Walker offers to help lawmakers reach consensus. Are House and Senate leaders close?
The only compromise that I see right now is the Senate accepting a fair and balanced budget.
The goal isn't compromise. The goal is to do what's in the best interest of the people of the state.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Military officials in Alaska say they launched fighter jets on Monday afternoon to intercept two Russian long-range bombers flying about 100 miles from Alaska. Lieutenant General Ken Wilsbach is the state's ranking officer and oversees all the military forces inside Alaska, including the F-22s that were sent toward the Russian planes about 100 miles southwest of Kodiak Island.
Exactly what happened is exactly what's supposed to happen, i.e. we have forces on alert. We detected something that we didn't know what it was. We launched, and if they had ill intent, we're in a position to where we could defend, and we can do that 24/7, 365.
Wilsbach says Russian military planes routinely fly in international airspace off the U.S. coastal borders, as well as other countries' borders. In fact, at the command center on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, where unidentified craft are monitored, dozens of red stars line the walls for each mission intercepting the foreign bombers. Wilsbach, who himself is an F-22 pilot and had just returned from flying a training mission Monday afternoon, says he wasn't alarmed.
What makes this somewhat unique is the fact that they haven't been in the Alaskan airspace in about 2 years. The last time it was July 4th of 2015, so that made this somewhat unique.
Often these types of missions happen on U.S. national holidays. Wilsbach says he doesn't know why Monday afternoon might have been significant, and he says when the American and Russian aircraft made contact, it was a courteous, professional exchange. Pilots even waved.
I'm not sure it's so provocative. They were exercising freedom of navigation. We do similar types of missions all over the world as well in international airspace.
It's the first time American jets have intercepted Russian aircraft during the Trump administration, and comes just a week after America's top diplomat described relations with the country as being at a low point during a visit to Moscow. Governor Bill Walker wants to bring lawmakers together to resolve differences over a plan to balance the state government's long-term budget. Walker invited leaders from both chambers to meet at the governor's house tomorrow, and he says he'll meet with them as frequently as needed while the legislature remains in session.
Me sitting back doing nothing is not an option either. And so now that they have put pieces on the table, many of which were similar to what I proposed last year, I'm more than anxious to sit down and have that discussion.
The Senate passed a bill that would draw money from permanent fund earnings and set permanent fund dividends at $1,000. The Senate also is seeking a new lower limit on state spending. The House's bill would draw money from permanent fund earnings, too, and would reduce PFDs, but PFDs would be higher at $1,250. The House also passed an income tax and changes to oil and gas taxes. Walker supports some form of broad-based tax and doubts the state can close the gap with larger spending cuts.
There's been a lot of discussion about what government waste is and what wasteful spending is, but I believe that wasteful spending is not feeding hungry kids. Taking care of seniors is not waste. Funding state troopers is not waste.
Anchorage Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says the Senate must move toward the House's position.
The only compromise that I see right now is the Senate accepting a fair and balanced budget.
House leaders say an income tax is needed to spread the impact of balancing the budget. House Rules Committee Chairwoman Gabrielle Ledoux says it's not enough to just draw money from the permanent fund, known as a percentage of market value or POMV draw.
I want to make this perfectly clear, that if the Senate thinks that we are going to get out of here with just a POMV, they got another thing coming.
Senate President Pete Kelly says the senators will meet with the House and Walker, but Walker won't serve as a mediator.
The goal isn't compromise. The goal is to do what's in the best interest of the people of the state, and to think that we're going to do something that's counter to the best interests of Alaska just to reach a compromise for the sake of compromise, that's not on our list this year.
Senators say House members who insist on an income tax jeopardize any long-term plan. While the U.S. House and Senate are on break, Alaskans who are alarmed by the Trump White House are pressuring the state's congressional delegation for a public meeting in the Anchorage area where they can air their views. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports their leverage doesn't seem to be having the desired effect.
Donna Marie says she usually doesn't get involved like this.
I think the last time I knocked on doors for a candidate, it was Jimmy Carter.
But this Anchorage retiree says the last election, the way it exposed deep rifts in society and her concerns for health care and the environment, have activated her.
Everybody online was talking about we need a town hall, we need a town hall, we need a town hall, but nobody was doing anything about it.
So Marie issued a Facebook invite for an organizing meeting. She says about 30 people have pitched in. A handful met last week at a tea shop in Midtown Anchorage.
Mike, right?
Yeah.
Donna. That is
Donna. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet
you.
Jennifer. Pete.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
They've rented a room at Rasmussen Hall suitable for a public forum. Marie says their town hall is happening Wednesday evening at UAA, even if there are three empty seats behind the name cards for Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan and Congressman Don Young. In the meantime, they're wrestling with the basics of organizing. Marie reassures the group they don't have to file disclosure reports with state regulators.
So, as far as I understand the rules, we are in the clear with that.
Okay. As long as there's no endorsement.
Right. Okay.
And we're learning as we go. None of us are paid operatives. We wish
we were. Most of us have never done anything before.
We're just people.
Yeah.
So
people on a mission.
The new activists consult national progressive websites like Indivisible and MoveOn.org. The sites advise adopting the tactics Tea Party conservatives deployed a few years ago, this time to resist President Trump's agenda. And like dissatisfied voters in Republican districts around the country, these Alaskans feel like their congressional delegation is dodging them.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Mike Anderson is the spokesman for Senator Dan Sullivan.
Senator Sullivan very much values connecting with constituents and hearing from his fellow Alaskans, large groups, small, what have you.
Anderson says the senator spent the first week of the two-week recess training with his Marine Reserve unit in North Carolina. Now that he's in Alaska, Anderson says Sullivan is meeting with as many constituents as possible.
He'll be visiting six different communities in Alaska, Dead Horse, Barrow, Wainwright, Anchorage, Homer, and Kenai.
Anderson says Sullivan can't go to the town hall at UAA on Wednesday because his flight from the North Slope arrives too late. Anderson says people who want to talk to Sullivan have lots of ways to contact him. But Democratic Party Chairwoman Casey Steinau says Alaskans want to tell their members of Congress that they're displeased about, for instance, a recent vote on internet privacy. And they want to do it in large groups to show the power behind their voices. Besides, Steinau says a public meeting is more efficient.
When somebody is in a room full of 200 people and that person says, you know, we have a real problem with selling our private information without our permission, and 200 people say, hear, hear, or yes, I agree. Well, then they don't have to have that meeting 200 times. They only have to have it once.
To highlight the lack of town halls, the Alaska Democratic Party put wanted posters of the delegation on its Facebook page. Young's office responded by posting a photo of the congressman facing constituents in Petersburg and the message, nice try, great meetings across the state. Young is scheduled to speak Wednesday at the Chugiak Eagle River Chamber of Commerce. Murkowski spokeswoman Karina Peterson says her boss has a full slate of appointments with people who requested meetings well in advance, and she didn't know of any meetings in Anchorage open to the public. Donna Marie says the public will have a chance to speak at the town hall she's organizing, regardless of who is there to listen. And if the evening goes well, she says, they'll hold another town hall the next time Congress is on break. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Anchorage dentist is charged with fraud.
None of the charges that I've brought have anything to do with there being any sort of dangerous aspect of his practice using IV sedation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
An Anchorage dentist and his office manager are facing charges of fraud over unnecessarily sedating patients, then charging Medicaid. The state's Medicaid Fraud Unit on Monday filed a 17-count criminal complaint against Dr. Seth Lookhart and his office manager, Shauna Cranford. Lookhart and Cranford allegedly put dental patients under unnecessary IV sedation. Lookhart's Clear Creek Dental billed Medicaid more than any other Alaska dentist last year. The charges say Lookhart even used IV sedation on a person simply getting their teeth cleaned, among other procedures that did not require such sedation. Paul Myovas is a prosecutor and director of the Medicaid Fraud Unit. He says the dentist targeted Medicaid patients.
A lot of their advertising was very clear that they accepted Medicaid and that Medicaid patients were welcome at their clinic. And they had direct mailings. They had a Facebook page where they would have rotating ads. They also worked with a lot of the review sites like Yelp and things of that nature.
Regulations say IV sedation is only to be used in emergencies or when other less risky and less expensive forms of sedation do not work. But Mayova says the charges are solely allegations that Lookhart and Cranford committed fraud.
None of the charges that I brought have anything to do with there being any sort of dangerous aspect of his practice using IV sedation. It is an accepted practice. He is trained. He is licensed.
The case is set for a hearing in court tomorrow. An online fraud scheme has bilked the Juneau Soccer Club out of more than $13,700. KTOO's Jacob Resnick has more.
The scam began in February when a series of innocuous-looking emails appeared.
It's a form of email scamming called spoofing, where they make it appear that the email is coming from someone in your organization.
That's Juneau Soccer Club board member Ellie Davis. The nonprofit soccer club has nearly 400 players, some as young as four, and organizes teams and tournaments.
The emails appeared to be from our board president to our board treasurer, and the emails requested that payments be made on an invoice for some soccer equipment.
The so-called invoices requested three separate payments, $2,800, $5,500, and $5,384. The board treasurer paid what appeared to be legitimate expenses. But when the club president denied ever making the requests, it was clear something was wrong. Davis says that's when the club took a closer look.
Hindsight is 20/20. When we looked back at some of the more detailed information in the emails that you couldn't get unless you were looking at it in an expanded view, the time zones suggested that they were not in Alaska or maybe not in the United States.
Fortunately, the club has enough savings to take the hit and doesn't plan to cancel any programs. Juneau Police Lieutenant David Campbell says the department is investigating the source of the emails.
The time that I've been with the Juneau Police Department, I've seen lots of fraud cases come through. I haven't seen necessarily a spoofing one come through like this one has, but I think that one of the best defenses that an organization can have is just really strong internal accounting principles.
The Juneau Soccer Club has a 2014 policy requiring two signatures for payments in excess of $5,000. Lieutenant Campbell says that's a good policy, though it wasn't followed in this case.
Having procedures in place that require funds to be distributed by more than just one person's authorization would go a long way. Having multiple eyes look at something before a transfer happens is always a good idea.
The soccer club's treasurer has since resigned. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Suspects are in custody for a Fairbanks burglary, robbery, kidnapping, and assault. According to a city press release, the incident began early yesterday morning when a business in the railroad industrial area was burglarized and a caretaker was assaulted and bound. It says the suspects proceeded to burglarize several buildings before fleeing with stolen property, including a vehicle and guns. Police say they were alerted by business employees who arrived and called 911 around 7:30 a.m. on Monday. The bound caretaker was transported to the hospital. Law enforcement tracked suspects to a building at 310 First Avenue yesterday afternoon. They say four suspects, including one who came out on the roof with a gun, were taken into custody. Sections of First Avenue and Wendell Street were closed down during the incident. Sunshine is abundant this time of year, but cooler temperatures this week have slowed the melting of a well above normal snowpack in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Ross reports, that's affecting migratory birds' arrival at a local refuge.
The first few Canada geese were spotted at Creamersfield Migratory Waterfowl Refuge in Fairbanks back on April 4th. That's among the earlier first arrival dates on record, but longtime Alaska Department of Fish and Game wildlife biologist Mark Ross says that can be deceiving.
Because it'll always be certain individuals of the species that are pushing the envelope to get to their breeding sites as quick as possible.
Ross says the larger migration has been slow to build, something he attributes to this spring's late-lasting snow cover.
We've had a big snow year, as everyone knows. It's above average, and there's still a lot on the ground.
Ross says during his 21 years running education programs at the refuge, migration has typically peaked at about 1,000 geese between April 22nd and 24th.
I'm hoping we're on track for that because that's when I've got about 600 school kids scheduled to come out to witness this great migration. And this is the 50th anniversary of the community rallying to help purchase the fields as wildlife habitat. And it's the 50th anniversary of the bird watch for fifth graders.
Ross notes that the peak abundance date is in line with the first arrival dates of 50 years ago. He cautions making assumptions about why, given that grain has been scattered for the birds at Creamers since the 1940s.
These waterfowl are very long-lived, and they've got a memory of this feed on the field.
Ross says Canada geese, which can live 15 years or more, pass that experience on to successive generations. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Living on an island can prove a major barrier to getting rid of large unwanted objects like cars or refrigerators, especially for small communities like those in the Kodiak Archipelago. In 2015, local partners in Kodiak began the removal of scrap metal and hazardous materials from the six island communities. Kodiak Area Native Association, or CANA, the Kodiak Island Housing Authority, and the Kodiak Island Borough partnered together on the project. They completed it this winter. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Before cars, trucks, refrigerators, and freezers can be shipped off the island, they need to be drained of liquid. According to CANA project manager Tyler Cornelis, waste does have the potential to contaminate village water sources or get into the streams, but that can be avoided as long as they're handled properly. That's what some village residents learned to do for the removal project. Cornelis says they hired a company called Total Reclaim to teach locals how to drain the objects.
To remove Freon from a refrigerator, for example, it's incredibly illegal, and it's not responsible to just release that gas into the environment, but rather you need to be trained to capture that the refrigerant with the proper processes and tools.
Riley Kaczynski works for Total Reclaim's Alaska branch and says he conducted trainings in Old Harbor, Yuzinki, and Port Lions, and his students walked away as certified Type 1 refrigerant technicians.
Everyone we worked with was awesome, like really motivated folks. They worked well together, and you know, they kind of hit the ground running after I left. And seeing some of the before and after photos from CANA, I mean, it's really impressive the amount of material that was removed.
According to the Canada press release, local partners disposed of roughly 2,600 tons of scrap metal, 28,000 pounds of lead acid batteries, 1,700 pounds of electronic waste, 540 gallons of hazardous waste, and 29 55-gallon drums of contaminated fuel waste. Cornelis says they transported the metal and hazardous materials first by boat to Homer, where a metal firm consolidated the scraps, and then shipped them down to Seattle. Catherine Atkins of Port Lions says it's amazing how a village with their population, which is roughly 200 people, can accumulate so much stuff over the years.
In fact, even now, people are calling today wanting to know where they can take their white goods, and that means, you know, just dryers and washers, refrigerators, freezers, and that kind of thing.
She says it's expensive to remove these materials and thinks they should figure out how to take advantage of backhauls from barges or other vessels to do it. Cornelis is also thinking about the future. He says they're unlikely to get the same funding again, and they need to figure out how to get rid of the scrap metal and hazardous waste on an ongoing basis. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Graffiti painted on the side of a World War II bunker in Unalaska has some residents expressing outrage on social media. KUCB's Laura Craigle went searching for the responsible graffiti artist.
On a rare sunny day in March, Dimitri Dane hiked up the backside of Mount Ballyhoo, where military structures from World War II still look out over the Bering Sea.
It's amazing. You can see the mountain range over there, you can see Hog Island, and the bunkers over there are on the very edge of the cliff.
As a landscape photographer, Dane says it's one of the best views in Unalaska. But as he walked out to the bunker on the farthest bluff, he came across something not so beautiful.
I was very surprised to see that the bunker at the very end had a lot of graffiti on there.
Tagging isn't unusual on the island, even for historic structures like bunkers and barracks. But these big black letters were spray painted on the outside of the bunker, not inside like most graffiti. Dane snapped a photo of the tag, posted it on Facebook, and watched as the comments poured in.
I got a lot of angry people, not at me, but a lot of them were angry towards the supposed people who wrote it on there.
No one's really sure who tagged the bunker, but the graffiti provides some clues. It reads, #722LifeMorganThugs.
It felt like a punch in the gut when you see that it has a Coast Guard tag on it.
That's Carlin Enlow, director of the Unalaska Convention and Visitors Bureau. She saw the photo online and drew the same conclusion as a lot of commenters, that the bunker was defaced by crew members of the Coast Guard cutter Morgenthau, designated number 722. For years, the cutter has stopped in Unalaska on patrol in the Bering Sea, protecting marine resources and helping with search and rescue. For Enlow, that mission makes the tag even harder to stomach.
It's a group of people who are supposed to serve and protect us. And, you know, all these questions come to mind. You know, obviously, just why? Why would you do that?
The Morgenthau's commanding officer looked into the matter after KUCB requested comment. The extent of the Coast Guard's investigation is unclear, but officials say there's, quote, no information available to confirm if crew members are responsible. In the past, the landowning company has given Coast Guard crews permission to paint the names and numbers of their vessels on blast shields decorating the side of Mount Ballyhoo, where the military stashed munitions during the war. Unalaska Corporation CEO Chris Saltz says the Native Corporation has almost had a good relationship with the Coast Guard, and he's not up in arms over this new piece of graffiti. But he says the corporation will pay to have the bunker cleaned this summer in an effort to preserve the area's historical integrity. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
A commissioning ceremony was held in Ketchikan last week for the U.S. Coast Guard cutter John McCormick. The 154-foot vessel is the first of six fast response cutters that will homeport in Alaska and the first to be homeported on the Pacific Ocean. KRBD's Maria Dudzak attended the ceremony and has this report.
Mm-hmm.
With warm temperatures and sunny skies, several speakers commented that it was a perfect day for a commissioning. The Ketchikan High School Band, accompanied by members of the 9th Army Arctic Warriors Band from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, provided pre- and post-ceremony music. Built under the Coast Guard's Sentinel-class program, the John McCormick is named in honor of a bosun who received a gold life-saving medal for a heroic rescue on the Columbia River Bar in 1938. In attendance were members of the McCormick family and descendants of Robert Bracken, the man McCormick rescued. The invocation was given by Chaplain David Alexander.
For this plank-owning crew of the fast response cutter, John McCormick, we ask nothing more at the beginning than that you give them the same courage and willingness to sacrifice as their namesake. Give them strength in their arms and their backs, in their minds and their reflexes, so that no challenge at sea is too great for them, especially when they are banded together.
Lori Hummel, Major General of the Alaska National Guard, read a statement from Governor Bill Walker.
Alaska has more coastline than all the other states combined, and it is a fitting honor to home port the John McCormick in the 17th Coast Guard District in Ketchikan, and for this vessel to defend our nation's interests from right here in Alaska.
Admiral Charles Michel, second in command in the Coast Guard, says Alaska is one of the most remote and challenging areas of responsibility for the Coast Guard, and it's fitting that the first fast response cutter on the West Coast is in Alaska.
And this ship behind me has been specifically designed to meet these most challenging conditions, to take head-on all that Alaska has to offer. The fast response cutter is a true game-changer for the United States Coast Guard and for the citizens of Alaska.
Admiral Michel then officially placed the John McCormick in commission and handed over command to Lieutenant Michael Moiseyevich.
On behalf of the President of the United States, I hereby place in commission United States Coast Guard cutter John McCormick. May God bless and guide her and all who sail in her.
Thank you, Admiral Michel. Executive Officer, hoist the colors and the commissioning pennant.
Captain Olson, please hoist the colors and commissioning pennant.
Martin McCormick, grandson of John McCormick, ceremonially presented a long glass to the officer of the deck, Petty Officer Timothy Truitt. The long glass is the symbol of the officer's authority on the ship. Each ship has a cutter sponsor who maintains a relationship with the crew and participates in ceremonies. Linda Jarmer, granddaughter of John McCormick, is the cutter's sponsor.
I know that he would be honored to see his legacy continue living on within the heart of his crew and all the future crews. He will be with you every step of the way.
The ceremony continued with the crew reporting for duty and the raising of the Admiral's flag, and concluded with a benediction by Chaplain Alexander, while the Army Band played the naval hymn, Eternal Father. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
The famous cloud cover of Southeast Alaska.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes, Casey Grove, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Laura Craigle in Unalaska, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, celebrating 40 years of production in Prudhoe Bay and support for the Alaska communities where BP employees live and work. Learn more about how BP gives back to local communities at bp.com/Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.